Hey, all you metalheads out there, welcome back to the show. I'm DJ Lovely Laura. You guys are rocking out on metalheadradio.com. Well, I'm ready to welcome my special guest today. He's been a part of some of rock and roll's greatest bands in history. I'm talking about Quiet Riot, Ozzy Osbourne with the late, great Randy Rhoads, Whitesnake, Dio, BOC, a little Blue Oyster Cult he's touring with now. And he's also got a great book out right now called Off the Rails. And he's also schooling some amateur rock and rollers as a counselor on VH1's Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. So let's welcome the very awesome Rudy Zarzo. Rudy, what's up?
Hello, lovely Laura. How have you been? It's been a while since I've talked to you.
It's been a very long time, so I'm glad to have you back. I'm at a new station now, and we got a packed house today.
Than ever right now.
We're what?
You're more lovely now than ever.
Oh, thank you very much. And so are you. You're holding well. You're like a fine wine, Rudy.
Holding well. Yeah, people ask me, what do you do? I say, I work out. I'm just trying to keep myself from falling apart completely. So I try to work out. And vitamins.
Yeah.
That's my secret. Vitamins.
Well, you look great.
But also, have you been watching the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp TV show?
You know, I don't have VH1. I barely watch TV, so I don't have...
The first episode is online right now. If you go to VH1.com, actually VH1 Classic, and search for Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp, you can view the first episode. But beware, there's no audio during the performances, but because for some reason they haven't cleared, I guess, this is just what I'm assuming, that the reason there's no audio is because they haven't cleared the sync rights for the songs.
I was just fixing to say that I did watch the first episode because I saw that you posted it over there on the Facebook, and I was so glad, and I was watching you guys over there at the Key Club.
At the Key Club, yeah, formerly Gazzari's.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like a lot of fun. I mean, tell me how this got started. I mean, to be able to attain your dreams like this, I mean, I wish they would have had this back in the 80s. This is awesome.
Yeah, well, actually, it's very simple. You know, it's a simple answer to a complex question. It's simple because, you know, the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp events have been going on for over 14 years.
Oh, yeah.
They have been doing it primarily in Los Angeles, London, and New York, with some of the campings in Las Vegas and so on.
Uh-huh.
And for the last 14 years, so right now we are doing what they call Weekend Warrior. It's like a little tour.
Uh-huh.
Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. We did one in Philadelphia last weekend.
Okay.
And we're getting ready to do this weekend in San Francisco, followed by another weekend in Dallas, and the last weekend for 2010 is going to be in Chicago. And what's really cool about doing the show is the fact that Mark Hudson, Kip Winger, and myself, we have experience doing these camps. So what happened is that Mark Burnett Productions approached David Fischoff, who is the founder of Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp, and actually bringing in the cameras into Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp and showing what actually does happen at Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. Of course, you know, it's a TV show, so it's just, you know, there's some minute variables on the television show from what actually happens at the camp.
Mm-hmm.
Just do basically because of copyright and, you know, like our song list on the TV show is a little limited because they have to clear every single song. Like every time you watch American Idol or any of the shows that have music in it that people get to perform,
uh-huh,
clearance. You just cannot go and perform anybody's song without their permission on television,
right,
or even on film.
Exactly.
So, you know, for our type of show, you know, there's some parameters that we have to follow as counselors and stuff like that. And one of them is like when you watch the episode number one online,
mm-hmm,
there's no audio during.
I know. I was like, I want to hear the band.
It's just legality. Okay. So you get the gist of what the show is about.
Yeah.
And, you know, Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp is all about, if I put it in a nutshell, it's giving people a second chance to follow their dreams to become a rock star. In my opinion, being a rock star is being at your personal best 24/7.
Exactly.
No matter what you do in life. So, you know, we get at the regular camp, we get all walks of life, usually a lot of A-type personalities, you know, a lot of CEOs and doctors and lawyers, moms whose husbands or kids want to give her a present, like a birthday present. Mom, we're going to send you to Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp because we know you write songs and play with Dad at the on the weekends and dance. You know, to me, the joy of being a part of it is actually helping people identify themselves with being musicians again in their lives. Because, you know, a lot of people that attend are actually people that had not only a passion but a dream to become a professional musician. And at some point in their lives, you know, thank God they make a decision to be a doctor or you know, something that it's for the greater good of mankind. But still, you know, they feel like, oh boy, you know, I could have been a musician. I go, no. If you play an instrument, if you sing, you are still a musician. Just because you don't make a living at doing it should not keep you from considering yourself, identifying yourself as a musician. Yeah, you're a doctor / guitar player.
Well, I think that's incredible because they not only get to, like, relive this dream that they had maybe in their youth. I mean, some of them are older, some of them are younger. I mean, it's all different kinds of people, like you said. But they get to play with some well-known musicians like yourself. Now, I want to know, I was watching that episode one, and your band, Proton Saints, is it true that you had a dream and the angel, or were you just kidding? The angel told you the name of the band?
Yeah, you know, finding a name for a band, again, it's a situation that for television, you know, or even to copyright a name, you know, because once we become an entity on television, you know, there's the dangers of somebody saying, hey, wait a minute. You know, my band in somewhere in the United States or even anywhere in the world, it's called Proton Saints. You know, so, you know, these are names that are actually cleared.
Oh, okay. So you cleared it.
You know, it's a Mark Burnett production. I mean, they're the number one reality show producers. They have you know, as the company grew, they've learned and they have faced all of these situations. And so they really covered themselves when it comes down to any of these aspects of the show that they could be legally bound by somebody, you know, saying, yeah, well, our band somewhere in Mississippi is called Proton Saints, so, you know, we're going to sue you guys.
Exactly.
You know? So every single name on the show is clear. Everything is clear, you know.
Uh-huh. So tell me a little bit about your band, the band that you picked out and working with these guys.
Well, you know, it's an amazing group of people, you know, and one of the things that I go through is I share the journey with them. We, you know, we're trying to compress into a 5-day or 6-day camp, you know, what usually the average band goes through in a year, you know,
wow,
year and a half, if they ever get to complete the journey, you know. So we go from, like, you know, it's kind of like, it's like playing poker for me. It's like, okay, they deal you a hand and say, okay, you know, these are the people that you get to choose from in the audition process. So you pick them.
Right.
And say, okay, and we're, you know, there is a challenge, which I love, which is taking 5 complete strangers and making a cohesive unit out of them, a band. And what I like to do is to go into their individual worlds and find references that I can connect with and they can connect with and bring that into a band situation, which is pretty much of a tribal community with a single goal in mind. You know, it's
Rudy's tribe.
Now, you got to do it so quickly, you know, because each episode is the equivalent of 1 day at the camp.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so everything that you see going on, it happens in 1 day.
Yeah.
And not only that, you might be focused and working on something, and in comes, you know, Lita Ford or Michael Anthony or you know, Ace Frehley or Bret Michaels, and you're like, you have to, like, interrupt what you're doing and accommodate the guest counselor, you know, that guest mentor that comes in and gives the your campers, you know, excellent advice, you know, something that they might never get the chance ever again, you know, from such experienced individuals, you know, to get knowledge, you know, from them.
Right.
And so, it's a process that we spend about 10 to 12 hours in a camp a day.
So when these guys get together, does any of them, like, actually stay together or get some
They are, yeah. I would say right now each camp, and not only for the TV show, but also for the regular camps. Oh, yeah. I mean, not only do they go on to stay together, but also they bring the experiences they've gained at the camp into their own bands, because a lot of our campers have their own bands, and they do weekends or weddings or whatever, you know. So, yeah, yeah. I try to give them as many tools that they can use once they leave the camp. And a lot of the tools, it's not just that they apply to a musical situation. They can also apply that to their own, right, in the, at the workplace or with their family or with their, you know, whatever spirituality they might have, you know.
Right. I know that you have some interesting people in the band, an awesome drummer, the singer who wears a kilt, and I know you're working with Heather Williams. And why did you say that you were going to be tough for...
I knew Shunagan.
Is that the... Which one's that?
That's our shredder.
Your shredder.
yes, our lead guitar player, yeah.
And why did you say you were going to be hardest on Heather?
No, I didn't say it was going to be hardest. I mean, if you watch the ending of episode one, I'd say, okay, now I know how good you guys can be, so I'm going to look for great. I want greatness out of these people because I know... well, you know, unfortunately, there was no real background on the individuals on the show. So, you know, in addition to Heather being a real estate agent, she's also a extreme sports fanatic.
I know. Amazing.
So, I mean, if there's a sport that can kill you, she's into it. You know, she's got bolts and nuts holding up her skeletal, you know, hierarchy.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
So, I mean, she loves, you know, she loves to face her fears.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, I guess, it's actually, you know, not really as much performing as it is being, you know, facing the dynamics of being in a rock and roll band. You know, one thing is to be behind the wheel of a car where you're in complete control. But once you're in a band situation, you have to learn how to give other individuals control of what they're doing. You know, you have to surrender that. You're not in complete control. You're in control of what you're doing, but not in a band of the dynamics of the band. So you have to learn how to share that responsibility with others. And that's one of the things that, you know, whenever an A-type personality comes into the camp, they must surrender a lot of that control that they might have. You know, these people might be bosses or CEOs or, you know, like, but they have to learn how to work with others, which is what a band situation is all about.
So,
you know, I'm a band guy. I'm not I'm not into singling out the singer as being, you know, and then considering the rest of the campers, the band as a backup unit for this certain individual who happens to be lead singer. No, to me, one of the things that I really put across from day one when I put the band together at camp, you know, when we're formulating that, is that I want this band to have each individual be irreplaceable. I want your contribution to be so important that if you are removed from the nucleus of the band will never be the same again.
Exactly.
And because to me, that is what a outstanding band is all about. All four, five or four or three individuals cannot be replaced.
Yeah, it's about the band becoming one unit together.
Exactly.
That's what you were saying.
You know, sometimes you have, you know, the type of personalities that have never dealt with a situation like that before, and they have quickly... Mm. You know, take that into consideration and say, okay, now I cannot be the star of the show or you know, they have the cliche of there's no I in team or there's no I in band, neither, you know.
So,
it's all about the message that you're putting across as a single unit.
So Rudy's whipping them in submission, all the control freaks.
Yeah, it's tough because we don't have time to, you know, to deal with the psychological, you know, mind games.
Right.
Like, I'm being very direct with the individual and says, you know, I'm going to be going in the journey with you guys. And, you know, I've been there. I've been from the bottom to the top with Ozzy,
right.
Quiet Riot, with Whitesnake here in the United States. You know, we were an opening act for Motley Crue, even though Whitesnake was, you know, superstars in Europe and Japan and so on.
Right.
But in the United States, you know, they Whitesnake at the time didn't have the same level of success as in other, you know, parts of the world. So I went through that journey also from the bottom to the top. And that's what I'm going through with them as I do Fat Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. It's guys, there's that incredible journey that I'm gonna grab you by the hand and show what it is like to go from the bottom to the very, very top. You know, and I get to live it all over again. And it's emotionally draining.
Oh yeah.
I was with you. Because I really, you know, I am consumed by it.
Are you able to go back in time, Rudy, like when you first began playing to kind of, you know, you have so much success, so sometimes you kind of got to slow it down, go back, being, you know, a great musician and all this experience that you have. Are you able to go back and remember where their minds are?
Well, not only remember, but also relive it.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm so addicted to, Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp, because it's going through that journey. Even if the cameras are not rolling, because to be honest with you, when the cameras are rolling, I have no idea. I mean, the production company is so professional, they never get in your way. So it is a reality show because I'm not aware of that the cameras are around us, and I really couldn't care because I got something that must be accomplished. I must lead the band, you know, through our journey. So I am not, you know, looking for, you know, I mean, sometimes certain things have to happen in the room that our producer wants to make sure that the cameras are present to capture it, and that's the only time that I'm really aware if the cameras are around or not. But most of the time, we're just working,
right?
Working to, you know, to get an outcome, and the outcome is to get the personal best out of the individuals and out of the band.
So, how many more episodes are there going to be besides this one?
Yeah, originally there was going to be 4 episodes, but they actually Yes One Classic liked the show so much that they extended it to a 5th. That is actually a 90-minute.
Oh, wow.
Fifth episode.
Nice.
And there's it's so much stuff going on. It's really great for me to be able to watch what goes on in the other camps because, you know, Mark Hudson has a certain style, and so does Kip Winger. You know, so it was really enlightening for me to see what the other campers do.
So do you think this has kind of not only changed their life, but your life too, kind of given a purpose to give back all the blessings that you've gotten from being a musician?
Yeah, great question, because it actually does. And it's not because I mean, it's great that we're able to share this experience on television and show it to the masses, not just to the people that happen to be in our room, you know, during the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp that we do, you know, not just for the campers, but if we can with the show just inspire somebody who might have their guitar sitting in the corner or in the closet, you know, to pick it up again, re-identify themselves as musicians, you know, as a guitar player or a drummer or whatever, and go out there and make music and communicate with your music on a weekend, or even, you know, take it to whatever level you want to take it to, then our mission has been accomplished. You know, if we can just take it that outside of what happens in the room, in the camp, with the TV show. But definitely it has been the most rewarding experience for me to be involved with Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp, not just the TV show. Of course, I'm very proud of the TV show, but also with the camps that we do around the country.
Awesome. So, you know, it makes me want to pick up my drumsticks again and go apply.
Why don't you?
I don't know. I was never that good. I was just the type that would go back in grandma's shed in the backyard, turn on the radio, and who knows if I was in tune or what I was doing. It was fun, though. I never started a band, though.
Yeah, so tell me, okay, when did you stop playing?
I stopped when I was probably about 17. I started when I was about 15. But I never, you know, I never did a band thing. I just always was kind of shy about it, you know. And I, being a girl, you know, it's always harder for the girls to get accepted in the bands and stuff, so.
Oh, no, you know what? I love having females in the band because it's the whole dynamic. It just finishes the whole, completes the picture.
Well, I don't know of any band you've been in with a chick, Rudy.
I've been in bands with females before, but what happens traditionally it's a one guy in the band winds up being the boyfriend of the girl.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
Then that's when the it gets a little complicated.
But why?
Why? Because then it goes from a band to a couple.
Yeah, that's
it
true.
It goes from.
Yeah, I don't think they should do that. I don't like
yeah,
that.
It goes from, let's say, Janis Joplin, and it goes from the Holding Company.
Right.
To the Captain and Tennille.
Right. It becomes too personal. All right, now I want to talk about this great book, Rudy, because I remember the first time I talked to you, I hadn't even got the book in yet. I had just ordered it off Amazon. You came on, you're like, did you read the book? And I'm like, I haven't even gotten the book yet, but you're on, so we're going to talk. So now we get to talk about this great book. Such a wonderful piece that you wrote, a tribute to Randy Rhoads. God, there's so many stories in here. I felt emotionally drained just reading this book.
Yeah, it was, again, it was an incredible journey, you know, for me to actually not only experience it firsthand, but also to write about it, because I got to reconnect with that. I got to rediscover myself by writing the book. You know, it's like you're taking personal inventory. And sometimes, you know, through the years, you forget about where you actually, you know, where you've been and what you've done, and you're just facing your present rather than learning from your past. And writing the book gave me that. I mean, something that when I sat down to write it, it was the last thing I expected to get out of the experience.
Right.
But that was my gift. That was my gift from... that I got from writing the book, you know.
So, can we talk about a little bit of the stuff in the book? Do you mind doing that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So you're coming to L.A. for your first time. You're actually going to go see Eddie Van Halen, but the concert sold out.
Yeah, I just got to town, and it was like, what's going on? What's happening? You know, the L.A. at that time was like, you know, if you wanted to make it as a musician, you had two choices. Want to go to the East Coast or the West Coast. And L.A., because of the weather, I already tried it in the East Coast, and the weather was a little bit brutal for me to survive as a homeless musician. And there happened to be a network. I mean, we didn't have Facebook back then.
But oh, I know.
A network of very kind ladies. That young ladies that would allow us to to crash at their place and let us stay until we got stable financially and find some recourses to be able to survive in Los Angeles and if any one of them is listening, I want to thank you. I mean, and on behalf not only of myself but every other musician that they helped out.
I might be in that category.
This is pre-AIDS. You know, this is mid-70s, you know, things were a little bit gentler then and not as dangerous. And it was all done for the love of music and the love of rock and roll, you know. And it was fun.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun, you know. But yes, I as soon as I arrived in L.A., was like, okay, let's see what's going on. Let me check out the scene.
Right.
So Van Halen was doing one of those coming back home gigs in, at the Whiskey. So I tried to get in, and I was sold out, and I didn't have any money to buy a ticket anyway. So I wound up going to the Starwood down the street, where I actually got to watch for the first time a Quiet Riot perform. You know,
okay.
And I got it. As soon as I walked in, because prior to L.A., I had been performing in the Chicago circuit, which was kind of like a breeding ground. like a lot of bands were coming out of the Midwest, and they will go to and play to the Chicago circuit before they make the big move to Los Angeles. So I got to watch a lot of great bands, you know, perform in that area. And I was also in one of the bands, you know. So I could tell, you know, from in the Chicago area, which were the bands that were going to break out, go to L.A. and make it there, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when I got to L.A. And I saw Quiet Riot, I said, oh, okay, these guys, you know, they're actually an arena band performing in a club, because they had not only as a conceptually, there was a bit of a production going on, but also their music and their performance really projected. They were a bigger band than the venue that they were playing at.
Right, they really put on an arena style show, I guess is what you said, in a small club.
Yeah, absolutely, and mainly having to do with Randy Rhoads' performance and Kevin. Kevin was a great frontman.
Yeah, he was awesome. Had the great attitude and everything. So you saw Randy play for the first time that night. You met Kevin. You got to talk to him briefly, and next thing you know, he was getting a hold of you, I think, to join the band. And I don't think a lot of people remember that you were actually in Quiet Riot before Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah, which is how I got the gig. If it wasn't because I played with Quiet Riot with Randy, he would have had no reference for me to recommend me to play with Ozzy when they were looking for a bass player.
And so that phone call from Sharon, Rudy, what were you thinking? I'm in another band? I mean, were you scared a little, or were you just kind of overwhelmed when she called you?
No, I mean, because remember, Ozzy was not the Ozzy that we know today. This is Ozzy before, you know, he was just the guy who had just been, he was out of Black Sabbath. My only reference to Ozzy when I got that phone call was that Randy was playing with him.
Right.
And Randy had come by my house doing one of his breaks and played me a bit of the Blizzard of Oz. So I knew that it was, you know, an outstanding record. Now, that it was going to be a legendary album, no, nobody had an idea. But I knew that it was something that I had never heard before. Just something, it was groundbreaking.
Right,
and just like anything in the business, you know, unless it's handled properly, people are not going to get to hear it.
Right, and you actually didn't get to record on the album because Bob Daisley had recorded, so you were basically...
It's hard to play on an album when you're not in the band yet.
But you're on the album.
It's like, I'm not in the band, but I'm playing on the record. No, I mean, it just so happened that they were looking for a new rhythm section, and, you know, Tommy Aldridge became the drummer right after Blizzard and Diary of the Madman were recorded, you know.
Right.
Tommy got the gig, and then they started looking for a bass player. You know, when Sharon called me, you know, I believe in commitment. I still do.
Mm-hmm.
And I always will. And I was committed to a band called Angel.
Right.
But even though we, you know, and my first reaction was, no, thank you. I'm playing in this band, even though I was sleeping on the floor. As I'm answering the phone, I'm laying on the floor.
Right. Well, didn't Kevin have a couch? What's up with that?
Well, yes, he did have a couch.
You want to sleep on the couch?
A room is a room, and
right.
The couch happens to be in the living room.
Oh, okay.
So you got to have some privacy. So even if it's the floor, you have to have some kind of privacy, too, you know. Yeah.
It
was my responsibility to get a mattress or a bed, but because of my limited funds, I didn't have one. It wasn't his fault, you know.
So it's amazing how these doors just open up for you. Your faith was a big thing, which I really admire that you talk about.
My faith is the number one reason why. But you know, in order to keep the book from becoming preachy,
exactly.
I mentioned it once in the book at the beginning, you know, chapter 2, and, you know, which had to do with the phone call. And
just before the phone call, yeah.
Well, yeah, if people don't get it, you know, they're not going to get it even if I keep, you know, mentioning throughout the book. The ones that do get it will get it once I talk about it, and that's it. And I move on. And they'll, you know, if that should be the major reference in the book, how I handle myself during the journey,
right,
has everything to do with my beliefs.
Exactly. I think it's so important, Rudy, for great musicians like you that have, you know, been in kind of secular bands to admit that, so that people can understand, because there's such a religious, you know, outbreak about, you know, you can be in a band like that and be, you know, it's just crazy. I get so tired of it because it's not true.
It's really ironic because I always felt that the reason why I got the gig with Ozzy was because of my belief, but I figure God is not going to put me in an evil band to play with evil people.
But yeah, he was considered one of the most, you know, kind of satanic bands out there. That's what's so ironic about it, because you were talking about you didn't see anything like that going on. I think it's just the religious perception of, you know, if it's...
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, even if you listen to a song like Mr. Crowley, it's not proclaiming Crowley to be the good guy. He's basically the villain in the story. You know, it's questioning why does Crowley believe in these things, you know.
Exactly.
And but just the title, you know, Mr. Crowley, it invokes all of these imagery. So people just take it for granted that, you know, the people that don't want to really listen to the song and know what it's about. It's like Suicide Solution. Suicide Solution is an anti-drinking song, you know, and actually was written for Bon Scott.
Wow.
Or, you know, who died from the alcohol poisoning, you know.
And I think everybody was kind of saying, well, that it's saying a suicide is the solution to your problems.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, Ozzy became such a controversial figure, even outside of the rock and roll realm, you know, people took him as a negative role model. And Ozzy never really tried to be a role model. He just tried to be Ozzy. You know?
Exactly. He was just
But as it happens, you know, with certain rock stars, you know, you do become a role model. But, you know, if you actually take a good look at Ozzy, he never really tried to instigate any negativity or any, you know, random acts of...
He really didn't. I mean, he may have done some pretty crazy antics, but that was who he was. I don't think he was doing it as some kind of sacrifice or crazy thing like that.
Example by his antics. He was just trying to deal with his own, you know, just like everybody has, you know, their own...
His own demons.
I mean, they're there, and it's just a matter of how you deal with them. But he wasn't trying to set a precedent or an example for anybody to follow, you know. It's like in the song, Don't Ask Me, I Don't Know. it's just like that, you know.
Well, you know what sets you apart, Rudy, from a lot of the bass players? You know, you're always used to seeing the bass player in the band kind of laid back in the back, not really the center, front and center. But, you know, you are just a showboat. You're fierce. You're out there. You're banging it. You're flicking it. You're doing everything you can possibly do on stage.
It's very simple. when I play, I get caught in the lyrics. I get caught in the song. What is the story? So I'm more of a storyteller than anything else. And for example, when I was playing with Dio, all those songs, all the lyrics, what an amazing storyteller, you know, Ronnie.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to be on stage, and he was mesmerizing.
Oh, yeah.
Characters. So, you know, I mean, you're either going to stand there and ignore the magnitude of the imagery that is being presented, or you're going to be involved and just capture and just, you know, embrace it and become part of the story.
Yeah,
which is, that's what I did, and to me, that was one of the most incredible experiences, to be on stage with Ronnie and do songs like "Men of the Silver Mountain" or one of my favorites, which I begged him to do, and we actually got to do it on a couple of tours, which is "Gates of Babylon." Mm-hmm. So I mean, these are cinematic, epic tunes. And if you just live them the way that Ronnie was singing them, then you feel the magic.
Yes, definitely.
Because to me, that's what it's all about. You know, just being wrapped around all the magic that was, you know, that was happening on stage.
Yeah. To me, Ronnie was a singer to what Randy was as a guitarist. He was just, you know, so exceptional in what he did.
Yeah, boy, I really miss Ronnie.
Yeah.
So much.
I know.
But, the magic was incredible.
Yeah, he was, you know, I cried for 2 days too, Rudy, and I really didn't know why. It was kind of, you know, like I couldn't help it. And I was like, well, you know, this guy has something. You know, it kind of, to me, when you feel that, and I mean, with you, you knew him personally. It's on so much a deeper level, but, you know, it shows how we're all connected, even when a loss comes, and we may not know that person personally. It, you know, I know how much he was an influence in my life, music-wise, and I felt that. You know, I felt a great loss when he passed. You know, it was really hard.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard even for me to talk about it. You know.
Yeah. Well, I know it's really
fun. You know.
I'm sorry, Rudy. I know it's really hard for you.
You just never get over it. You just, you just kind of like try to learn how to deal with it.
Well, you know, Rudy, having the faith that you have, you know that they're living on. So you know it's not the end. You will meet them again. You know what I mean? You're going to see them again. You've had this life, Rudy, that you've got to be friends and play in bands with these people that people would only dream about, you know, to even have the slightest bit of knowing who they are. That's what this book is all about, because all the people asking you, what's it like? How, you know, Randy was only here for such a short time. What was it like? You know, you're the one. You're the voice, Rudy. You know?
Yeah, you know, actually, it's a book that I wish, you know, somebody else would have written, because, you know, it's because of the time. It took me about a year and a half. I mean, I'm so proud that I wrote it, and I'm glad that I had the guidance to do it,
right,
and to keep me going from page to page,
right,
and not give up on it, or, you know, things can happen. And then after, you know, not only after it was done, I faced a lot of, I'm trying to find the politically correct word, but a lot of...
backlash?
A negative response.
Well, that's
you know, and even when the book was still not available for anybody to read, but it was just the fact that I did it that started getting some kind of, you know, negativity out there. But
why would there be negativity? Was it because you were exposing certain things about Ozzy and Sharon, or what was that about?
No, because, you know, since the book was not available, the individual was not able to know what the content of the book was about. So I think it just had to do more with the fact that I did it rather than the content of what I did with it, you know. Because, you know, once you read it, you realize that the book is a celebration,
yes,
of that time and of the people, you know, that they are the subject matter of the book,
right,
rather than any, you know, dirty laundry or anything like that, you know. But, I don't know, writing it gave me a sense of closure, which was the greatest gift that I received from writing the book, even if it sold one copy.
Right.
It gave me that sense of, like, okay, I did something for Randy.
Right.
Who had done so much, not only for me, but for all of us.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I don't... He's amazing. I mean, you know, Rudy, reading that book, I mean, it's pretty obvious that he saved your life. He saved all your lives. I mean,
yeah.
For, you know, and there's a scripture I know that talks about that there's no greater gift that a friend could give than to lay down his life. You know, and I... You know, it's amazing to see that he did this great thing, you know, to save you guys. This is just what was meant to happen, Rudy. I mean, but I think the book also, maybe there were some feelings about that when you had to go relive all this, that maybe there was some part of you, Rudy, that wasn't all the way healed from it, and you needed some kind of, maybe you got some kind of, you know, healing from it, because you had to relive it again, and you had to sometimes, do you understand what I'm saying?
You know, we didn't have time to mourn. We just...
Yeah, you kept going with the tour, and I mean, you had a few days off, a few shows off, but not really properly, you know.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes... Go ahead.
No, as you know, as you can read in the book, I mean, Sharon wanted to keep Ozzy from having idle time, you know, just like, you know, getting off the road or anything like that.
Right.
Because she feared that he might hurt himself.
Yeah. Yeah, that was that part when you were in the church and Ozzy was in there, that was a very touching part that you didn't even know it was him. Remember?
No. And, no, because at a moment like that, you just want to keep to yourself, so you're not even looking at your surroundings.
Right.
You know,
I couldn't help but to feel sorry a little bit for Ozzy, too, in that book. I mean, to see the side of him when you came to him and talked to him about if he knew God, and to see him going into the psychiatric place or wherever he was at, you know, I felt for him, you know?
Yeah, but, you know, that was Ozzy then. I did not, I was not on in his daily lives, you know, from 1982 until today. So, I occasionally run into him, and we say hello, and, you know, and so on. But I think that he's gone through his own journey, and I believe that that he's gained, you know, a lot of experience from it, and I'm pretty sure that there's a lot of rewards, you know, spiritual rewards that he has received from the journey and everything. You know, it's life. You know, you just experience things and you grow from it, and you know, and become a better person from it. And I think that Ozzy has, and Sharon, and everybody that we were involved, you know, in our own lives with, you know, as a group, as a family, you know, in those days, I think everybody has become a better person.
Yeah, definitely. So what? Tell me what Randy Rhoads' personality was like. I mean, I pretty much know by reading the book, and I love it. He's pretty much a simple guy. Wasn't really, you know, in the spotlight after the show. He wasn't like that.
Yeah, Randy was the perfect example of breaking down the cliche that those that can't teach. Because Randy could, not only could he compose and perform and play, but he set the bar on a new level of doing all of that.
Yeah.
But at the core, he was a teacher. You know, I spent a lot of time with Randy at Musonia, which is Randy's mother's school here in North Hollywood. And he spent more time teaching than he actually did performing or playing or recording.
Right.
He had a huge list of students that he would teach every single week. And when he started playing with Ozzy, he never lost that sense of being a teacher.
Right.
You know, he would have the opportunity to meet, you know, guitar players, you know. Even when we'll play in areas where, like, there will be, like major music schools, let's say, like, Boston or, you know, or Berkeley, you know, around San Francisco area and so on, there would be, like, all these guitar aficionados, you know, waiting for Randy backstage, and he would, like, take the time after sound check and get together with them and talk about music. And if you look at any photos of Randy performing live, you can see that he's actually holding the guitar in a way that he's showing you very clearly what he's doing. You know, which is basically, if you were in the first few rows in front of Randy, you were going to get a guitar lesson, you know, out of that concert. So, Randy was not only a rock star, in every single aspect of his life, but also a teacher.
Yeah, I think that was his calling, being a teacher, working at the Musonia with his mom, and you said all his family was musically, you know, talented, but I think he got that taste of being a rock star, but he was going back towards his roots, you know, when he wanted to leave the band and everything, seems like he was ready to go back to where it all started, you know, Randy realized that.
Yeah, and it's also really interesting that, you know, he never really found the time to actually enjoy the financial rewards that he was getting you know, from selling all the records and, you know, being in such a successful band. And because he was still living at home.
Right. Still living with mom.
He still had the same car that
I love that.
Join Ozzy, you know. He just didn't have the time.
Right.
They just get, you know, between the Blizzard of Oz and the release of Diary of the Madman and the tour to support it, we had about 4 weeks off. That was it.
Right.
You know, so he just went home.
Yeah.
And hung out with his girlfriend Jody.
Yep.
Ordered Chinese.
Yep.
Little trains.
Those little Z trains.
Yeah, and that's it. We went back on tour again.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's awesome. Well, I recommend this book to anybody out there who hasn't gotten it yet. I know you, I probably have one of the first versions. I don't have as many pictures or the autographed copy, but you have a new one out, right, that's autographed with more pictures?
Yeah, it's been available for a couple of years now, at least, and it's a new layout.
Okay.
You know, it's a new layout, and it's got photos and everything. Yeah, it's like the official release. You know, the other one was pretty much a... What happened was that I had a publishing company that I signed a deal with, and right before the book was going to print, we got some you know, they were faced with some whatever threats, I guess, from certain people about the release of the book, and they were pressuring to dropping the project, so I was dropped. And when that happened, you know, there was the buzz going around the internet that the book never existed or the book is never going to see the light of day. And then I came across the actual possibility of printing it as a print per order with a company that was aligned with Amazon.com. And so I went ahead and finished the book myself as far as the layout.
Because,
you know, that takes a long time, you know. And also creating the cover of the book and so on. So yes, it was available for a little while as a print per order book.
Right.
And a publishing company approached me and they actually released it as a, you know, they redid the layout and added some extra photos and so on.
All right. You know, so where can people
catalog and yeah.
So where can people get a hold of that?
Very simple. You know, I think if you order, you can either order from your local bookstore or it might be sitting there on the shelf.
Awesome. It's everywhere.
Also, you know, like Borders or Barnes & Noble.
Awesome.
You can also Amazon. But if you want to get an autographed copy, the only place to get it is through actually my website, which will take you directly to the publishers.
Uh-huh.
And you can order autographed from there. Not dedicated. No, because what they do is they send me like a few boxes.
Uh-huh. And you actually sign them?
And I write bang your head and I sign it. Then I put them back in the box. I ship them back to them.
But you're doing some book signings too. I don't know. I think I'd want to go get a book signing.
Yeah, I did a book signing. Actually, it was a Q&A book signing. And I was like talking for about 2 hours straight. And, you know, before anybody even asked me a question, you know, and I just went on and on and on and on. Not only about the book, but the music industry versus what it is like today, or the way it used to be.
Right.
You know, not only is the book about it's about my journey with Randy and you know, in Quiet Riot and Ozzy's band, but it's also a time capsule about what it was like back in 19. You know, in the late 70s, because it talks about Quiet Riot during the late 70s, I was trying to get a record deal.
Right.
You know, when they had basically given up on hard rock bands, and they were just signing new wave and punk bands, you know, in Los Angeles, to actually, you know, touring with Ozzy, and the way that it was grassroots touring. There was no internet. This was pre-MTV.
Yeah, MTV was great.
Yeah, so in order to make an impact, you have to, like, tour everywhere.
Yeah, MTV was like internet today for the music scene, I think. But, you know, I read somewhere in the book that Randy was on a laptop, and I was pretty shocked about that.
No.
I'm going to find that, Rudy.
No. What I talk about was if Randy would have had a laptop, in those days, you would have been very productive and would have written a lot of songs. I mean, there were no laptops in 1982.
I know. I thought I saw something. I'm going to find it. I'm going to confront you.
I know.
All right, so speaking of the 70s,
the only technology that we had then was the Walkman that we had just been introduced. The Walkman, that was like the biggest thing. You can actually listen to the music you want with your headphones, and you don't have to listen to anybody else's music. You know what I mean? You know,
it's an
experience, you know. And the Canon SureShot, which is the camera that actually focused dramatically.
You know? Yeah, I remember all that. Barely. Yeah, I wasn't born until 1970, Rudy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're 10 years old, walking around. I bet you had your first Barbie Walkman around 1982, 83.
I was actually in L.A. in 85. I think I just missed you. I think I just missed you. Some friends of mine were in a band out there, and they're like, I'm like, did y'all meet Rudy Zarzo? And they're like, oh, yeah. But I had left. You know, L.A. scared me. I was too young. I wasn't ready for L.A.
You were 15. What are you doing in L.A. at 15?
Well, my mom did the old reverse psychology thing where, you know, I was with the bass player.
15?
At 15, and I wanted to go run off to L.A., and she, instead of saying I couldn't go, she bought me the ticket. And it really screwed with me, because by the time I got there for a couple weeks, and we were living hard and rough, and my
15, oh my God.
Yeah, but when I was 15, Rudy, I looked about 18, so you know.
Yeah, but legally, that bass player could face some years in jail.
Shh, be quiet,
I mean,
Rudy.
You were underage.
I was. Yeah. But, you know, I had my parents' consent, so, and my mom knew that it's someplace
okay.
I really...
Okay, I'm not gonna go there. That's a little... yeah. But anyways, I'm glad to see that you grew from that experience, you know.
All right, so you're touring still with Blue Oyster Cult, playing some of the 70s old rock and roll that you grew up with. What's that like with the guys?
It's amazing, because I started playing in the late 60s, and then the 70s was really my formative years. That's where I drew most of my references, you know, from bass players that I grew up listening to, whether they're rock, metal, or funk, you know, or, you know, even some disco, you know. And playing with Blue Oyster Cult is great, because they do everything. You know, there's a song in there called Shooting Shark. That actually, Randy Jackson from American Idol. Now, Randy Jackson, before he was a judge from American Idol, he was actually the bass player in Journey.
And, really?
You know, yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that. What? I did not know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was just like the two original guys. Well, maybe one, because by then Neil Sean was actually the only original member of Journey before Perry.
Right.
You know, before Perry joined the band. Greg Lally was the only lead singer, who was the keyboard player. See, Journey was an offshoot of Santana. You had Greg Lally, and you had Neil Sean, who had both been in Santana. They put together this band, which was mostly instrumental, almost like a jazz fusion band, you know, named Journey. And Perry joined the band, and then they became more of a pop, you know, commercial success.
Mm-hmm.
And then little by little, so a lot of the guys got replaced. So before you know it, you know, Greg Raleigh got replaced, the bass player got replaced, the keyboard, and the drummer got replaced. Ainsley Dunbar got replaced by Steve Smith. So Randy Jackson, then Steve Smith got replaced by Mike Baird, another drummer. And Randy Jackson replaced the original bass player. And then Randy was also a number one call guy, you know, for doing studio sessions, you know, as a funk, you know, slapping bass player. So he played on this record, Shooting Shark, and his bass lines are just like, you know, really cool funk slapping stuff, and which I used to play that.
Yeah, kind of back to your Cuban roots there, Rudy, with your brother.
No, actually, it's nothing to do with the Cuban roots. It has to do with more with playing disco and R&B, and growing up in the 70s in bars and playing in bars in Florida, you have to play those songs, otherwise you you couldn't, you weren't going to get a gig, basically. So, you know, so I, in my musical vocabulary, I got, you know, R&B from playing a lot of Motown. I got metal. I got funk. I got rock. I got psychedelic 60s, whatever, you know, Cream, blues, you name it. So when I play with Voice of Cult, they do all those styles. Like, yeah, so I say, oh, that's great. I can play it this way. I can play it that way. So, you know, we go from metal, kind of like, you know, with either Godzilla or Cities on Flame to some funk, you know, with Shooting Shark to some Beatle-ish stuff, and you name it. It's all over the place, but wow, it's fantastic.
Yeah, that's nice.
I love it.
That's nice.
I love it. I mean, you know, bands in the 70s were not really boxed in into one certain style. You know, you could be, you know, you could put out a single that sounded a little bit, you know, like a ballad, and then come out with something heavy, and then come out with something danceable. You know, look at Kiss. You know, they had I Was Made for Loving You, Baby, and then, you know, they came out with Beth, and they came out with all these, you know, Rock and Roll All Night.
Right.
So, yeah, and it was expected. You know, it was expected for a band to go through a musical journey, you know, as far as different styles grow and stuff.
Yeah, I think rock became more danceable, you know, especially in the 80s for the girls.
Danceable, yeah, but you have to in order to compete with everything that was going out there. And very few bands were able to survive that, you know, with some dignity.
Right.
once MTV or let's say corporate rock started happening, that's when your style became more dissected. You were more sectioned into, okay, you're a heavy metal hair band. You're only going to play these kind of songs, and your record's going to sound like this. You know, so it was basically the music industry trying to find a easier way to market you.
Right. Very cool. You there?
I am here.
So what's going on, Rudy, with the studio thing, the studio that you opened up, the recording studio? Is that still up?
Oh, yeah. I'm working a lot with my brother.
Oh,
and he's like, you know, I'm a junior partner in the studio, but we do a lot of work because I'm rarely in town, so, you know, he gets to do the bulk of the work, you know.
Yeah.
And when I happen to be in town, that's when we get together and work on doing various projects, you know, anything from soundtracks to actual, you know, other projects. But it's usually having a lot to do with the film industry.
Yeah.
Because, you know, since the film industry is based here in Los Angeles, we get a lot of clients that we can actually...
Yeah, I remember Robert from Hurricane, and he also auditioned for Ozzy when you were in the band.
Yeah, it's in the book. I get to write about it, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you're doing a lot of that 3D stuff. So I saw how you had some videos now that you're doing 3D.
I'm sponsored by Fuji, and they have the only camera in the market that is a 3D prosumer camera.
Oh, that's
just,
cool.
You know, high end. Yeah, it's like if it's for the consumer and it's for the professional because it shoots HD. Also, so it's a very complete camera. Not only can you shoot stills, but also video.
Oh, wow.
Moving pictures.
3D music videos.
In 3D,
maybe that's next.
Yes. Yeah, and because of like software like Sony Vegas, you can actually render in different formats. Not just anaglyph, but you can do passive or active, you know, or, you know, for those that can actually watch the 3D in their 3D television sets.
Oh, wow. There's 3D television sets?
Yeah. Go to Best Buy and check them out.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
I will check that out. Well, Rudy, I'm just talking you to death, and I'm just going to leave it where it's at right now. You know I'm going to put you on the spot, though, for a shout-out, because you never sent my shouts to me. I know you're busy, but I'm going to do it to you right now, okay?
Okay.
You know what to say?
Hit me.
All right, go.
What do you want me to say? Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, you know my name, and you know the name of the station, I hope. What's the name of the station, Rudy?
Ever the station is the greatest station in the whole wide world.
And
where rock and roll lives.
He doesn't even remember what station he's on right now. It's Metalhead Radio, Rudy.
Metalhead Radio.
How can you forget that?
And your Metalhead Radio. Oh, boy, I love it.
All right. Yeah, so basically, you know, hey, this is Rudy Zarzo. Hey, Metalheads or Headbangers. I know you like to say Headbangers. Nobody says Headbangers anymore. They say Metalheads, don't they?
Metalhead. Yeah, I think that's what the kids are calling it nowadays.
Yeah. You're rocking out with DJ Lovey Laura on Metalhead Radio.
Okay.
All right, I'll tell you when to go.
Everybody. Okay, let me know when you're ready.
Go.
Hey, everybody, this is Rudy Sarzo. You're listening to lovely DJ Laura on Metalhead Radio.
Awesome. Well, it's been a pleasure, Rudy. We
it's
definitely...
fine. So sweet. And, you know, like, are we off the air? Or
no, not yet. Hold on a second, all right?
Okay.
All right, you guys. I hope you enjoyed that awesome interview with the legendary, fierce bass player Rudy Zarzo, who's playing right now with Blue Oyster Cult, but you know him from Quiet Riot, Ozzy Osbourne, Whitesnake. He also did some stuff with Yngwie Malmsteen we forgot to touch base on. He also played with Dio, and he's got a great book out. We were talking about the book a little bit today. We didn't want to give too much away. We want you guys to get out there and purchase that book. You can go on over to his website. I think it's rudyzarzo.com. Is that right? Read it. Yeah, go over to the website and you get this autographed copy. And be sure to check out the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp that he's doing right now on VH1 if you haven't had a chance. He's posted episode 1 over there, or you can go to the VH1 website and check out episode 1. All right, guys, let's kick it with some more rock and roll. I think I'm going to play some more Dio. This is Straight Through the Hearts.